The topic I'm going to tell you about today has to do with droplets in microfluidic devices, and mostly about the motion of droplets in microfluidic networks. And this is work done in collaboration with a lab, which is a mixed lab between a chemical company in France, Rodia, and CNRS, which is the kind of equivalent of NSF or something like that in France. And where you'll see both experiments and theory, and those guys are the one involved and who did most of the work. And essentially, because they were entering this topic, and there will be a few other talks on droplets, I think, given the kind of, in my understanding, broad range of kind of interest of the audience, I will do a little bit of introduction about a common thing that interests people in droplet microfluidics. Then I have a very short thing that tells you how we entered a bit this problem. So that's one example. And yeah, this is to say when you have to focus and what would be entertaining. So the first part, you have movies, it's moving, it's nice. 9 o'clock in the morning, you wake up. This is a simple story. Then I go to maybe what's the gist of my talk. I'm a theoretician, but there won't be equation or at most no equation. But still, that involves a bit more thinking, so you have to be awake at that time. And then, because you will have been doing some work, I'll show you an example of way we found to achieve a kind of rather efficient regulation of the motion of droplets in networks, which is a passive solution, meaning you're not using actuators from the outside, but you just design the network so that you get the functionality. And there's a nice movie here, so you're rewarded for the effort you make here. And then I go back to the story in one here to show you how this kind of device can help doing that, and that's again something simple. So here you have to work. So introduction as to droplets and microfluidic devices. I'm sorry, this is a kind of very crash-fast thing, the story, but basically it comes to the fact that there are many ways by which you can produce in a kind of regular in space and time way droplet by just flowing streams of non-miscible liquids, like here two oil streams and water in the middle, and if you look at it dynamically, it's kind of very periodic, nice. Again, here maybe this is could be 100, 200 microns. The thickness of a channel would be here, I don't know, 50 microns in the other dimension. This is just to tell you, you can make this object, they're largely submillimetric, and the production can be very kind of regular. And one of the main reasons I focus on today, whereby you can think of using those, that has been advocated mostly by the group of Rustem Ismagilov in Chicago, but has led to things, I think, Darren Link, when he will be giving his talk, has a company who's working on principles that are related to that. The idea that in each drop, if you control the composition of a drop and you put something in the drop, you can think of each drop as being a small, separate microreactor where you enclose a few things, and then as you move them downwards, the important thing is that they don't disperse. If you use only one phase of liquid and you put a solute inside, when you push with pressure, you tend to have Poiseuille flow and you get hydraulic dispersion, meaning that you inject the sample at one point, and as you flow the thing to move it to other parts, you're going to spread it enormously, and so you lose the resolution you had from the nice little injection. Here you're making little separate compartments where you've enclosed some amount of chemicals, and the idea then is you move it in your network, and as you move, reaction can occur between whatever you've put in the droplet, and there are ways to do mixing, I don't want to enter that, but the idea is that if you're doing this at constant flow rate, if you locate a droplet downwards in the network, or downwards in the channel, let's say in the simple case, you can know how long it has taken since it was formed. So you know how long the chemical species have been in contact, and therefore just by getting a kind of, you're running the thing in a steady way, and you take a picture of your system, and you see droplet here, you know it's been formed for 1 minute, and so if you see the outcome of a reaction, you know that the reaction takes less than 1 minute. And there's this idea that you're running the thing in steady state, you look at distance travel, and it tells you what time has elapsed. And so a good control of knowing, of having this little reactor gives you a very good control of time. Please, again, this is supposed to be the kind of introductory thing, so don't hesitate to interrupt me if something's not clear. And this has been used by a few groups. This is, again, a picture from the Ismagilov group, where basically they're here flowing two things in an aqueous stream that react to give a fluorescent product. So what you see here, this is a steady image average over many drops going through, is that fluorescence developed after probably a distance of this order. And looking at the flow rates, you can go back and calculate the rate of the reaction. Then you can change the concentration here and look, for example, at the order of the kinetics or things like that. But just by taking this kind of average picture, you can see the reaction developing in time by looking at something developing in space. So this kind of space-time correspondence. This is an example of a reaction that's in Jensen's group at MIT, where they synthesize in the droplet. This is just studying the reaction constant. And here is doing the chemistry and the synthesis. These are particles prepared in microchannel, just flowing one phase. So you have hydrodynamic dispersion. And because you have hydrodynamic dispersion, you have larger and smaller particle, colloidal particles. This may be maybe 200 nanometers or something like that. Just because some bits have spent more time in the channel than others, because some were closer to the wall, some were more in the middle, so they were moving at a different speed. So this is without the drop. This is without the droplet. This one is if you do the chemistry inside the droplet and you see it's much more monodispersed, that's because you had better control of time and you didn't have dispersion. So that's one of the interests of the droplets, very good control of time. Then you can try to do more complex games that evolve the fact that you can prepare one droplet and then you can think of cutting the droplet in two, and they have been studied in the group of Ismagilov, they have been studied in the group of Dave White at Harvard on this. So for example, here you have an incoming droplet, and at the junction it will break between two parts, you have two daughter droplets, and then you can have ways to recombine daughter droplets from different things, and you can think of playing combinatorics games. So you prepare the product of reaction between A and B is in this droplet, and you divide the droplet, you make 10 daughter droplets, and you recombine them with some other droplets, and by doing this, you could think of doing some kind of parallel screening, or trying to combine products in a different way, or screen a drug against libraries, or things like that. And so the talk I'm gonna go through has to do maybe mostly with slightly more sophisticated functions than just preparing the drop at one place and just looking at the steady flow of drop without doing anything. And the thing I'm gonna tell you about has to do with control of not these operations, but again, something like if you start to go into these more involved things, how do you know where a bit of daughter droplet here originated from, and can you keep your clock still secure by controlling how the droplets are moving? And the two typical avenues that are advocated, the word that are used a lot in microfluidics, are active and passive. Active means you add something in your microsystem so that you can control and move one drop to this side or to this side. So that means more complexity in fabrication, more maybe energy to operate the thing, but better control. And there are passive solutions, which are you try to have something built in your network so that spontaneously you have a control. Usually they're less efficient, but much better in terms of fabrication, much cheaper. Yeah?
In this application, the droplets are normally driven by pressure gradient?
Yeah, in most cases. You could think of using electric fields to do that, but I think in that case you would want the water phase to be outside, so by control of the ionic strength, you would have better control of electroosmosis and so on. But all the application I know of are mostly pressure driven. Okay, so that's just to give you, because that's a nice movie, an example of a place, for example, where a droplet is formed. You will see there's a fluorescent droplet. It's running. It comes to a junction. And here you're controlling this pressure whereby you can suck a little bit of a droplet. And what you see, the droplet will be running from left to right. And in the course of a movie, so you have a small channel here, and the pressure will be decreased so that there's more and more sucking. This is just to show you the amount of control you can expect at the junction. Again, come on, please. Yeah. So you see, that is low sucking pressure. So you deform the droplet, but you're not sucking a little bit. Here you suck like maybe 5% of a droplet, 10%. And again, if you increase the sucking pressure, and just the purpose of this image is just nice. But also it shows you that if you operate, you can get rather regular operation of this, and so break the droplets in a controlled way just by changing pressure at different places. But this is a very simple element. You only have this kind of okay. So that was the introduction. Do you have more questions on that? Otherwise, yeah, go ahead.
I saw the droplet spacing change.
Yes.
Is the droplet spacing determined by droplet size?
The point is, you see, let me go here, because that's really to think something that comes. Even when you don't see anything going in this channel, you're still supping the continuous phase. That's dark here. So you're always extracting some of this phase. And actually, here there's none of the fluorescent phase going here, and you're sucking, so the distance has to reduce here before what it was. So just mass conservation that can help you. The complex part here is mostly the breakup process, deformation of the droplet and so on. This is very complex. And I must say, all these things whereby you generate the drop, you break the drop like that, there are some arguments like capillary numbers. If you go very fast, inertial effect can come into play. But But I would say that there's no kind of global easy understanding. You're thinking of something where the geometry of a channel, the geometry of a junction is important. There are lots of non-dimensional numbers, the ratio of viscosity from inside to outside. So there is not kind of simple map with two non-dimensional numbers that tell you how these things break up and so on. Then once you've looked at the process of breakup, the kind of spacing and things like that, you tend to try to get by mass conservation, like the amount of a continuous phase is divided between the two branch, the amount of thing. Mm-hmm. But it's the rule of what happened at the junction, which is kind of the complex bit here. Are there other questions? I'm spending a bit of time on the introduction, but that's more general than my personal fancies that I'm after. Okay. So an example case where we wanted to have a slightly more complex network was this idea that typically when you produce the droplets, you can produce them at almost kilohertz, so 1,000 droplets per second. Usually you push quite fast, and that's because that gives you this kind of steady operation I show you. But then the point is, if you want to study a reaction that goes on in the droplet that allows you to access timescale like milliseconds by looking at the motion of the droplet in a kind of microfluidic chip. The point is, if you have a reaction that develops in half an hour, for example, or you don't know if it's going to happen in a minute or half an hour or a few hours, the point in many cases is that given the rate that you use to produce the droplets, the droplets have exited the chip because the chip is only a limited amount of space before you have the half hour. So the question was, how can you access large varying range of time scale? And the idea is you can try to go slower, but as I mentioned, the production of droplets sometimes becomes less robust and less regular, or you can make very long channel and try to do spirals, but then you need huge pressure to achieve the same flow rates and you have complexity with that. So one way we looked at the problem was try to do branched networks, and it starts with something that would be here, like you're flowing the droplet from top, this little thing would be the thing that makes the droplet, and then you make this kind of tree-like thing where you divide the channel into parts at different space. And the idea is that at each junction, mass conservation tells you that the velocity decreased by a factor of 2 in each of the branches. And so if you were doing this kind of hierarchy, you would be going slower and slower and slower in an exponential way in the different branches of the hierarchy. The point is, if you look at how much channel you need here to do the whole thing, you have lots of channel everywhere, so in terms of real estate, that's not the best thing. So what we came to was to say, oh, let's take only part of a tree here. So you would still have a division of velocity at each step by a factor of 2. And if you want to draw it in a more efficient way, this is just to show you how this is related to that. But you could think of something which is here. You send in the droplets here. Here, all these ends just go to like outside atmospheric pressure. And what you want to do is just to divide the flow by a factor at each of these branch, and then this would be like kind of semi-log thing. Here you have a linear structure, but if you look at the velocity, it's decreasing exponentially along the structure because you're dividing by a common factor after each division.
Is it obvious that the factor that you divide by is the same with every node?
I'm coming to that in the next slide. Thank you. You're a great chairman. And so that's the idea, and that's so this is a kind of, you see, it's not a very complex network, but already I will show you have more ingredients in that than just kind of straight channel. So the usual way of answering Mr. Chairman's question is, how do you make sure that you divide by a common factor at each of the branches? And the usual way, when you have simple fluids, to think about that is to say, oh, I can essentially describe, use the fact that the flow at those scales is linear, low Reynolds number hydrodynamics, so I have a relation between the pressure drop over a segment and the flow rate through that segment, which is linear. And the resistance here essentially has to do with the shape of a cross-section, it's where we go and so on. This is essentially proportional to its length. So by choosing the length of a segment, you can choose the tune the resistance. And then it's like a little game you could do in electricity, and I assemble resistors. All the exits here have the same potential, and I want the current to be evenly divided. And you can just work out the calculation simply, and if you choose like this length to be one-half this length, at each places the current sees something that has equal resistance on the two sides. So you just design the thing like that, and that gives you an equal division, and that's a way to go through. So the point is, we made systems like that, and there are good and bad. If we flow through the system a single phase, like solutes in water, we indeed observe the division of the flow in a nice way, and the exponential structure, and so on. The point is, now we're trying to do that with droplets, and then when you send droplets in those structure, the droplets do crazy things, like they're not doing things that are not stayed in time, they tend to all go in one side and so on, and that's the question, how can we operate structure like that with droplets? So this is just a way to enter the main question of my talk, which is focusing, for example, from this network, what do droplets do when they arrive at a junction? Because like every time you're going to try to make a complex network, it starts by saying channel device branches or something like that, or we can buy. So to rephrase my question more generally than the simple example I mentioned, is the idea is that if you have a junction, like suppose like it's this what's called T junction, I'm sorry, I'm swapping between these two pointers. So you have a flow rate Q that's going down here, and that's divided between QA and QB, and you have outer pressure, suppose you control, for example, the pressure outside. And if you have a simple fluid, again, what I just told you before is, if you have this kind of monophasic fluid with non-Newtonian liquid, you can just calculate the resistance of this branch, the resistance of this branch, and then you can calculate, for example, the flow rate that goes here. It depends on the ratio of the resistances of the two branches, so their length, essentially, and it's also related to the difference of pressure between these two ends, but that's just like kind of linear solving the system, that's very easy. What's more complex is, what if you are actually sending in drops? Because you have a drop that arrives here, so that's a drop and then in the liquid, and what does it do? I showed you a picture before, and that's something, for example, Darren had studied, and there were, as I mentioned, studies in the group of Ismagilov, is if you're going fast enough, the point is that the droplet, the shear forces, extensional force, would be strong enough to break the droplet. So you have a two-order droplet, and the size of a two-order droplet is controlled by these hydrodynamic things, and it's already a kind of not simple problem. I'm going actually to focus on something that's maybe even simpler, and yet what I'm trying to show you is that the hydrodynamic forces are not enough to break the droplet, yet the situation is already difficult. Because I'm saying is, this droplet drive here, suppose you're going slow enough so you won't oppose surface tension appreciably and break the droplet. The point is the droplet will have then to fully go in one of the two branches, even if the two resistances like are 45% and 55%, the droplet completely goes one way. And then you can think you have the droplet keep on coming, and then they make choices that are digital, is yes or no, and they have fully to choose one side. And I'm going to refer to one set of experiments that was done actually in this lab in Bordeaux, which is not microfluidic, they call it millifluidic. Essentially, you have capillaries with inner diameter that are slightly below a millimeter, and it's droplets of oil in water. So coming in here, and you look at the droplets coming out, this large thing, I mean, actually the tubing here is just as I was kind of schematically drawing it before. The nice thing with those is they have a circular kind of, or disc-like section. They're easier to observe. And what else did I want to say? Essentially, just to keep notation, the study we've made is a system like that with two branches, different length between the branches, and we call R the ratio of the longest arm to the shortest arm, L1 divided by L2. And we leave just the liquid flow out at atmospheric pressure. So there is no applied difference of pressure between the two ends. And the question is, where do the droplets go? As you can see on the picture, in these experiments, essentially, we changed the size of a droplet, but they were always at most comparable to the diameter of a capillary. So those were not long slugs filling the capillary over some distance. And the question is, how can you analyze where the droplets go? We have just arrived at the place where you have to think a bit more, so let me try to drive you how to prove a system. Essentially, what we try to do is here, we have a system that produces the droplet. It's essentially a syringe that, actually it's water and oil, that injects the water in the middle and the oil around, so you get the water and oil droplets. These two numbers we don't change in the experiment, so we don't modify the fabrication of the droplets. The droplets in one set of experiments have the same size. They come with a certain frequency F here. What we do is we inject a bit more of a continuous phase oil here so that we dilute the droplets. And this is our control parameter, essentially. And we report our result as a function of what we call the dilution ratio, which is the ratio of the sum of these two things, so how much oil compared to how much water. So if we increase this number Q, that means we have more oil, meaning that the droplets are more distant. But at the same time, we're doing something else. We're not only changing the distance between the droplets, we're also making them go faster, because the total flow rate is increasing when we're changing that. So essentially, our control parameter makes the droplet go faster and being more spaced. The temporal frequency is still F, because that was the rate of production. So there's the frequency of a droplet is the same, just the distance increase. And we look at the frequency in the two branches below, branch one, that is the longer, and branch two, that's the shorter.
Does this side produce some pressure backwards, so as the flow rate?
Essentially, when you look at the range of pressure, these things are rigid and are made to impose flow rates. It's imposed flow rates up to here, and then downstream, We have just pressure here equals pressure here. Okay?
Yeah.
And so essentially what comes out of this thing, and so we're going from here to there by increasing the dilution, this dilution factor. And essentially we see what's called in, well, phase diagram behavior or whatever, reentrant behavior. That means here, if you have low dilution, so small distance between droplets, and droplets are going rather slow, you have some droplets go on the left, some droplets go on the right, and you have water going into two things. You increase dilution at some point, all the droplets go one way, and you have no droplet, but you still have oil leaking out here. If you increase it even further, you go back in this regime where now the droplets start to break because you're going fast enough, and so you have the water going in two sides, but all these are daughter droplets that come from the breakup. And this is what Darren, for example, has studied, and it's a picture borrowed from another paper, where the droplets successively break into smaller and smaller bits. Here I'm not going to discuss about that again. I'm only going to discuss about droplets do not break. I'm going at slow speed. So I'm just going to think about this transition between all droplets going one arm beside all the
critical flow rate is what you would expect, namely it's the flow rate at which you can, the shear forces are large enough to break it.
This one?
Yeah.
Yes, although the actual analysis is not simple because, or essentially that was the argument in their paper, which I think is rather correct. You have to measure the droplet comes. Here at this point you have an extensional flow,
yes,
but it involves in a kind of rather subtle way the size of a droplet because it's going into against the front wall here, where the flow is actually stagnant. So the largest extensional rate is not on the wall, but it's a bit before. And so the actual exact description of this geometry in 3D is rather complex.
Right, but
the global scheme, more or less, it's in terms of Capillary number, and you can rationalize that. And I'm not going to discuss about that. Okay?
And sorry, are you going to explain why there are two regimes?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to explain. Kind of. Okay. And so these are pictures, just again, this is, forget about this, we're just focusing on here. So as I increase the distance between the droplet, I dilute, I go from there to there, and the picture looks something like that. And actually, when you get closer to the transition, you see that also you tend to have more irregular pattern in the distance between droplets, like with this big distance. So essentially, the way we think what controls this thing, and just to show you that this system is more complex than it looked like a just thing flowing at low Reynolds number and arriving at junction. What we think is happening is that you can still apply this kind of rule that at instantaneously you look at the thing, you have still this pressure balance that tell you have these two branches, and the amount of liquid, think about the continuous phase that goes into the two branch, is controlled by the difference of hydraulic resistance between the two branches because you're connecting to the same pressure. But the point is the hydraulic resistance of each branch now does not depend only on their length, but depends on how many droplets there are in, because the droplets modify the flow pattern. The droplet can be more viscous, but also you have all this recirculation around the droplet. You have, depending on the shape of the channel, Bravatton thing, films, rubbing of a thing. So essentially, you modify the hydraulics of a problem. So you must know how many droplets, and in principle, where they are, because you could have interaction between the droplets.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole point is, at every instant, how much goes to the left and to the right has to do with the integrated history of what happened before, because it depends where the droplets are. You forget something only when the droplet exits completely by the end of the branch. So if you make the branches long, you have long time memory. And the second rule that we kind of apply is when a droplet arrives, it's not going to break, so it has to decide one way or the other, and we're assuming that it will follow the leading flow rate, which seems reasonable. That this is a decision is made kind of locally. So the idea is that you compute the resistance of the two things knowing where the previous droplets are. That gives you, is Q1, the flow rate to 1, larger than Q2 or not? And each droplet arriving follows the leading thing. And you have to update the thing after, because when the droplet has chosen, it modifies the resistance, so the next droplet will see a different environment. So you have to see that each droplet making a choice changes the balance, and each droplet leaving at the ends changes the balance. And so you have this kind of long-time memory and this complex dynamical system from something where you don't have capillary breakup, whatever. So it's a very simple thing. It's a very simple junction, and yet you have complex dynamics.
I'm on
yes?
The flow rate could change, the directional maximum flow rate
yeah.
could change
yes,
on
in
a
time
scale of as the drop
yeah.
Translates
yeah.
through the inertia.
Oh, that's why this is a very simplistic description of a thing, because as you were mentioning, like if you're at 51.49%, you could have a droplet starts to go one way, therefore it starts to bias the rule,
right,
and it brings it back to 50%, 50%. So what it does then, I'm unable to describe the subtleties of that. But I'm saying this is the kind of, again, you could have interaction between the droplets, and I show you a picture of there are some, but I'm just saying that's the simplest way of thinking about it. Think about points moving, and when they arrive, they make a choice one way.
You kind of mentioned the idea of history and memory here, but could one not think about this sort of by saying that at any given time you take a snapshot and say this many drops are on the long branch, this many on the short, and so that determines everything at that instant.
Yep, that's what I'm saying.
But there is no, so you don't have to think of it as a memory dependent thing, but obviously the history determines.
Yeah, it's your arms have stored them. It's from the point of view of a junction, there's a memory because what happened at the junction in earlier time is imprinted in what's in the arms. So the memory lasts only as long as the arms are.
But you don't really need to know. A snapshot at the current time will tell you the future. You don't need to know earlier information.
I kind of agree.
Kind of?
No, I agree. I agree. It's just that my reading is the snapshot is a kind of kernel, kind of integrated things of what happened before. But that's somewhere. But I agree with all what you said. And not kind of. Sorry. Okay. Yes?
Are you going to assume that the one droplet limit is valid at that transition? You're interested in?
Yeah. In that picture, I'm going to do everything following this kind of rule. Let's say I have one drop arriving, it sees what was the balance, it chooses. Then I change the balance and I see the next droplet arriving and I do this, so with no interaction between the droplets, and I comment on that. Yes?
If the situation happens to be perfectly symmetric, then the drop has to break out, doesn't it?
No. The point is, the situation will never be completely symmetric. If you try to make something symmetric, you're just hypersensitive to any small details, any small noise, and that will control the system. And that was what was happening in our trees, where we were trying to have one half, and one half is maybe the worst situation from that standpoint because you become hypersensitive. There is a small fluctuation of pressure. If there is something, a droplet that's slightly larger, you start to imbalance your thing and put in the dynamics of where the droplets are going, things that you didn't control at first. And that's, I come back to that.
But isn't this determined by surface energy? What if it is, energetically very easy to break up?
No, here, in all these contexts, it's very difficult, so they will never break up. I'm going slow enough, they won't break up. So they could. What will happen, actually, if you manage to have something very symmetric, is a droplet will sit a longer time at the junction. So it's hesitating, it sits long, and then there will be something, a little thing that will do. You have to realize, of course, you're never able to fabricate a perfectly symmetric system. So the point is, what you say is will be the next part of the talk is, if you're aiming at 50%, you're in problem because whatever the quality of your fabrication or your noise control, the thing will get berserk and you lose control at some point. Yes?
Could the choice of the droplet to move in one channel or the other depend, as you're saying, that the non-symmetry in the micro fabrication, so it will always go to one of the channels due that the resistance in that channel is a little bit smaller?
The point is, each time a droplet goes one way, it will increase the resistance of that channel. So if there was a bias that tends to send the droplet the other way, if the bias was really small, then this droplet will offset the thing and you will tend to go back to the first thing. But still, you're in a kind of limit situation and then you have to describe the full geometry. I'm just saying like the 50% gives you a large sensitivity to things. There are some subtle things that have to do with the ratio between the actual length of what I call the arm and the distance between droplets. You can have commensurability issues or things like that. In principle, it's a bit subtle, but what I'm saying is just, in principle, it's a very simple system. Again, I'm saying surface tension doesn't come into play because the thing does not break, and yet the dynamics is already very complex. And you have a situation where you think it looked like a lot like chaos and whatever. Okay, other questions? Okay. So the way we try to model this system, because you need to write like kind of conservation rule, the flow of the two liquids have to kind of sum up, you have to describe the motion. What's important is when you decide to send a droplet in one channel, question is, how long will it stay in that channel before it exits and then you lose that memory? And actually, if you have droplets that are not completely filling the channel or very large compared to the radius of a channel, they don't move exactly at the same velocity at this continuous phase, and so you have to account for that. So essentially, the two parameters, I'm sorry, I told you there would be just a few equations. The two parameters we need are one thing that says, again, this is a kind of dilute limit approach. We have an excess of resistance per droplet, if you work out the things, like each time you have one more droplet that adds up something to the resistance. Actually, that's not exactly true. If the droplets are very close to one another, they don't modify the hydrodynamic resistance the same way than if they're far. But in this kind of dilute limit approach, I just have a penalty per droplet. And in my notation, I call this LD, which is the apparent excess of length of this branch due to the presence of one droplet. So, which is like, and here you have a ratio L is the length of the arm, lambda is the distance between droplets, so capital L divided by lambda would be the number of droplets. So there's a term that's just due to the channel and a term that's proportional to the number of droplets. So this is one parameter that describes, that depends on the viscosity ratio, the size of the droplet, and so on. But this is one parameter that say, what's the excess resistance one from the snapshot? And the second parameter I need is, what's the relative motion of a droplet with respect to the continuous phase? That has to do, again, with their size and the ratio of viscosity. Like, for example, if you have a very small droplet, and you have a parabolic quasi flow, it moves at twice the average velocity of a continuous phase. As you make the droplet larger, it moves closer to the velocity of the continuous phase. Again, that's supposing the surface tension is so large that these parameters are constant because the droplets are almost not deformed by the flow.
Did you study that in channels?
That there's
a velocity difference between the droplets
and the sizes. So these are things where we try to get the numbers from experiments in the same channels. And so this is the one that tells you the excess of resistance per droplet, you don't have, but this is essentially what gives us this LD, and that linked to the fact that the little equation I have here, this is the typical inverse distance between droplets, and that's the increase of pressure. And just look at the straight line, it works, and we can back up what's the additional resistance per droplet for different sizes of droplets. And here, that was your question, that's the velocity of a droplet plotted against the total flow rate. And you see the difference here are more minor for some of the sizes, but the deviation from here, the slope here tells you what this beta coefficient is. Yes?
So how much does it depend on the inlet and the exit conditions? If you change the geometries of the inlet and the exit, you change the flowing and out, would you change this prefactor?
No, all these two parameters are supposed to describe, and we measured them experimentally by putting a pressure measurements on channel. So this is on channel, and you could always wander close to the exit of channel that you have slight corrections, but we're neglecting those.
So this is just in the bulk, you
have a capillary of constant cross section, and there is one parameter that's the increased pressure, and one parameter that's the kind of relative motion of a droplet with respect to the flow rate. And again, this will depend, those numbers will depend a lot on the geometry, size of a droplet with a side channel. If you have a rectangle channel, they're not the same that if you have a cylindrical channel, and we shall discuss it. So what we did, kind of, pragmatically, we do experiments, we take these numbers, we go back to our little assumption about, like, you take the snapshot to decide which one is the winning flow rate, and you send the droplet in that direction. So just to make the thing clear, one thing, the easiest thing to study is actually this kind of what I call filter regime. It's a filter without obstacles, if you want. Like, you have only openings that are comparable to the size of a droplet, yet no droplet goes here, which is actually functionally a way to reduce the distance between droplets here. You can inject continuous phase to increase the distance, but you can also suck out part of a continuous phase without doing anything, which looks like the first movie I showed earlier, if you were not going fast so as to pinch a bit of the liquidy. Essentially, this regime is easy to understand. This branch is shorter than this one. So if it was only filled with oil, this resistance would be lower. So the flow rate here is higher. So if I send a droplet in a very dilute way, arrive one by one, and leave before the next one arrives. So single droplet arrives, smaller branch, larger branch, so larger flow rate, and I go always to the same direction, because the winning flow rate is always the same. If you increase the density, you start to have more and more droplets on this side. And so at some point, even though this branch is shorter, if you have too many droplets, the hydrodynamic resistance of this becomes larger than that, and that's when you enter the regime where you start to have droplets on the two sides. So that's just the rule for the extension of this kind of filter regime. You have to appreciate here that it looks very simple, yet we need the numbers I mentioned before, because you need to know what's the distance between these things and how long they stay there. You need the parameter beta and the, how they modify the pressure to decide the extent of the range. But this we can back up from just the measurement we have. So I don't want to enter the thing in too much complexity. Let me just tell you what this graph is. This is the dilution factor. So here the droplets are very far from one another. Here they're closer to one another. What's plotted here is the frequency, temporal frequency of a droplet in the two branches. What's the time interval, average time interval between two droplets, divided by the frequency in the incoming branch. So what you have on the right here is just the description of the filter regime. You have in this branch, the frequency of droplet is the same than here in time, and there is no droplet here. So this is just all droplets went into this arm, no one here. Is that clear? Any big puzzle, Michael?
Well, I was just wondering, can you convert Q to the distance between the droplets?
Yeah, I could.
But like roughly what, I mean, just what are we talking about?
You mean?
I mean, like what Q, the 10?
Actually, if you look here, the distance between droplets is comparable to the diameter of a capillary. So the, the dilute assumption should start to become incorrect.
Before that, in fact.
Before that, kind of. That's comparable. So I'm saying, I'm just saying, right at the moment, you have the experimental symbol here that tell you this is a filter regime, and this point, for example, that's for one set of experiment, correspond to a certain frequency in this short branch and a certain frequency in this large branch.
And so you're the discrepancy is on the far consistent.
Okay. First, look at, so I'm just saying this is, these are the experimental data, so I've got nothing to, yes?
Sorry, what is the dilution factor? That's how infrequent are the droplets? Or?
The dilution factor is amount of oil divided by amount of water. And oil is a continuous phase.
Okay.
So here I have lots of oil and only a bit of water. And the droplets have always the same size. So I'm just not modifying the size of a droplet, so it converts. And I think we made a mistake. That's not a nice way of plotting it, but that's how it comes out. But just the physics this way. The point I want to make is the look only at the dark line here. The dark line is what we get from our little model, just taking the parameter beta and LD I mentioned, and say, well, the extent of the filter regime I just described you, it's your infant filter regime until the resistance of a shorter branch plus the effect of a droplet equals the resistance of a longer branch. In this regime, what we say is we have droplets going on both directions. So we make this kind of a bit ad hoc approximation that, oh, if in time some droplets go to the left and some droplets go to the right, that must be that the flow rates are fluctuating around 50-50. Because if you were on average very far from 50, all the droplets would go in the same branch. So if in time you're fluctuating around 50-50, we say that the total flow rates is approximately divided by 2. And then we look at how much droplets in which branch you need and so on, and that gives you this prediction. So that's a very simple mean field kind of thing, where we model the complex dynamics of a choice of each droplet that should depend on instantaneous condition, a kind of average thing that just say, oh, it's fluctuating around 50-50. And that gives you this line. There's no adjustable parameters because everything is taken from the kind of experimental fit before. And so depending on where you sit, you could say, oh, no, it doesn't work, or it works because you have no adjustable parameters. And again, that's come from the dilute limit modeling of this system. And in principle, already here, dilute limits shouldn't work that well. So we think that at least it lends support to this kind of picture of how droplet design.
I'm sorry if you just explain this, but why do those lines go through 40 and 60? The thick ones?
In that case, those lines go for 40 and 50. The fact that it's 40 and 60, I think, has to do with a specific ratio of length that you have here when you work out the model. There's no way you can figure that out. This is
why don't they go through the, why don't they meet?
Because even if you had lots of droplets in this kind of model, you still have one branch that's shorter to be than the other. So you should always have more droplets going here than there.
System.
Yeah, it's not symmetric system.
Okay.
I'm sorry. This whole thing. What helps to have this nicely divided regime is the fact that you have a built-in asymmetry, like, I don't know, in that case, it may be 1.3, the ratio of the two lengths.
Okay.
Again, if you're trying to make it 1-1, you don't have this nice thing because you don't have a filter regime to start with. They can already oscillate.
What is sort of strange, I noticed, that you extrapolate the data.
Yeah.
It doesn't actually cross a finite Q.
Yeah, okay, I'm coming to something that's linked to that. Okay, so here our data again. What I'm going to plot here is this value QC. Where do I go from filter to droplets going both directions? Yes?
So what is the rate? What is, I mean, is this 0.4 on one side and 0.6 on the other side of the channel. Maybe what's the actual geometry for this block?
This is the frequency of drop. Yeah.
Not the scale, but what is like the channel on the top?
Yeah.
What is the actual length? If the overall length is 1 meter, what are the lengths on each side?
Oh, the typical dimension here were maybe like.
Is it 0.4 meters and the other one's 0.6? Is that?
That's the order. I would say one is maybe 0.2 and the other one 0.25.
But
or
it's
something.
Not exactly. It's. I mean, if it intersects at 0.4 and 0.6, I would think it would be exactly 0.4 and 0.6, because I mean, at dilution factor of zero, it means that you know, if it's just one liquid, 40% goes to one.
There's a slight correction that has to do with this parameter beta and the speed at which they go. When you work out the separation to the two things, it's not as simple as just being R. You also have something that has to do with the relative motion of the droplets and the quantum phase. But it's, you can work out, it's linked to the, directly linked to this imbalance in the geometry. Yes?
Can you
point
again with the y-axis?
The y-axis is the frequency of droplet in time. You count what's the frequency that you see the droplet if you look at one branch here, divided by the frequency in the incoming branch. So if it's one, that means all droplets went there. And the sum has to be one, because the frequency there and the frequency there totally make the total frequency problem. Okay, one more effort, and then we'll move to the easier thing. So this is the transition between filter and this kind of thing where you get water in the two thing. And this is a plot of this value as a function of the drop size normalized by the capillary radius for three sets of asymmetry of a two branch, so the ratio of a side of a two. I just don't look too much at the detail. The whole point is the little theory I showed you would be something that I could train, which is like a dashed line. So if you make the droplets quite large, comparable in size to the capillary, it works quite well. Actually, if you make the droplets smaller, it completely goes the other way, in a bizarre way, it's non-monotonous and so on. And the fact that the thing increases means actually the thing is more equally spaced between, I mean, equally divided between the two branches than I would have anticipated from my little theory. So here it's more, I tend to spread the droplet more evenly between the two branches. And we're working on this, but the kind of analysis of what you get here is you're hitting the situation that the thing is not dilute. So you have problems coming from the interaction between the droplets. And one thing that we see definitely is that, so we have the incoming jet is here, and these are the two branches view from top. I hope you can see there's a droplet coming here. Now it's kind of smaller than the capillary. Because it's smaller, it goes to the end wall. Here the flow is more stagnant, so it takes some time to make its decision. Mm-hmm. The next droplet arrives, mm-hmm. and what happens quite often during those collisions is that the next droplet will push it one way or the other, but will go the other way. So you have a collective mechanism between droplets that tend to divide the thing more equally than if you were in the dilute limit. Mm-hmm. And we have some rationalization, but essentially we think that's responsible for this trend, that as you make the droplets smaller and smaller, they have this tendency to stagnate here, becomes larger, and then they, through this kind of dual collision, they tend to split more evenly than you would anticipate with this kind of simple theory. So the message here is, I just show you a very simple kind of theory or understanding of a thing, and I think that's correct, the fact that the resistance of a branch changes, and so it's a complex dynamical system. Actually, in many situations, when you don't want the droplet to be too much spaced or so, you have this collision effect that comes into play and can also make the thing even more complex.
If you continue to make the drop smaller, then it'll go back the other way.
No, I don't think.
Well, it's a question of how long it waits.
The
thing
if they
smaller,
are tracer,
but
if they are tracers and before the those, then it would just be the same.
Yeah, at some point when you start to put diffusion or things like that also in.
No, without diffusion,
yeah.
It's just a passive tracer, but eventually it's going to become back to the case of just a pure fluid. And they're just going to do what you said at the beginning.
The point here is that there's a mechanism by which before they tend to be rather well centered, so they come right along the axis, and if you make them very small, yeah, because
mm-hmm.
you're going to decrease their feedback on the flow rate, yes, maybe. Yes, I don't know. Okay, so I realize we've been through the tough part, so just wait, there's a nice movie coming in. So that's an analysis of, yeah, so the message is, yeah, a junction, things can be complex, right? Kind of big summary. Okay. And you have this built-in memory of what you did before is affecting what you do. So if you start to have noise at some time, it will also disrupt what will happen afterwards. Okay. I'm coming back to this tree we were trying to make. Our problem is we want to divide the flow evenly, a half, a half. And ideally, we will want like the droplet to arrive and they go one to the left, one to the right, one to the left, one to the right, and that's what we want to do. And what I told you is we have this problem because what the other decide in affect the system, so noise can perturb the system. So essentially what you would want to do is that when this droplet arrives, it doesn't feel or look at, hydronomically speaking, all the droplets that decided to go this way or the one that went this way. You would want it to focus on, oh, what happened in recent history, not long time history, and say, oh, because this droplet is here, this one should go this way. And we found a little trick that allows you to do so, which is an advantage of microfluidic system, is you fabricate the network, so you can modify the topology a bit. So what we made was what I call a bypass. Is suppose you make a side channel here. It has something here that prevents droplets entering there, but it establishes a hydronomic connection between this point and this point. So if pressure is higher here, it will circulate some fluid here, and the reverse, and you prevent the droplet from going in, and I'm drawing this larger because I want it to have low hydronomic resistance. And actually, if you look at what happens if like this droplet chose to go this way, suppose it's a bit blocking the flow, that means actually you tend for the continuous phase to circulate, rather than trying to keep on going this way, it would tend to do something more like that, even to flow here. Like suppose the hydronomic resistance here is low. Still, from here it would do that rather than try to go this way, and so it will tend to entrain this droplet to the left because this one was here. So we have a feedback in the direction we wanted. The previous droplet went to the left, the next one is more likely to go to the right because of this kind of comparison of a hydronomic pressure here and there. And yeah, there's just a thing that you don't want the droplets to enter here. And you can rationalize that just using kind of the hydronomic surrogate. That's not equation, but just let me just flash whatever comes. Essentially, if you look at this little device, you can show that if you make the hydronomic resistance of this thing low, essentially the ratio of these two flow rates here, locally, almost doesn't depend on the hydronomic resistance of these bits or the pressure imbalance of the two sides, but it's very sensitive to the difference of these two resistance. And so you're very sensitive to, oh, in the recent history, did droplets go here or there? And that's the whole idea of eliminating whatever happened long time ago. And our first kind of design for this was something like that. The T became an engineered Y. Mm-hmm. The way. The Y instead of T is just something that told you was had to do with network imbalance and so on. Actually, the engineering of the local geometry of a junction can be important in the sense that collision, for example, were shown to induce some problems. If you take a Y instead of a T, you reduce the extent of a stagnant region. So we observe we have less problem if we use a Y. So some you have both local and network engineering at the length scale of a network.
That's what nature does.
Huh?
That's what nature does.
Yeah. And this is not very efficient. We have other design, but that's the first one we try. So we have this bypass. It's large so that the hydronomic resistance is low. And it has this kind of obstacle built in so that droplets would not enter. Yes?
But don't you have a shearing point now at the very tip?
Here?
Where it's going to want to split.
Yeah, it's going to want to split, but still if you go slowly, they won't break.
Okay.
It will, if your aim was to break them, this is also more efficient than a T.
So Reno's number is low enough that it won't
Capillary number is low enough so that here I'm not breaking them at all. You've seen that. So that's what we've tried to use. And so now I told you there would be a nice movie, so let me just tell you what you will see. We'll start, so we made a device just to compare how good are our junction without models, just make one with and one without the bypass. So essentially we make droplets, we distribute them evenly, you'll see, that's the first thing you'll see here, and there is a bypass, so you'll see droplets going one way and the other, nice alternation. That's kind of interesting, you say it's work, but the most interesting part after the movie will be moving upwards and we'll enter this region, where you have two junctions that are made in the same, so all parameters are, to the best we can do, the same. One symmetric junction here without the bypass, and one symmetric junction here with the bypass, just to show you what is typical thing we observe if we have a bypass against not having it. And of course, if it comes at the end of the talk, it's supposed to work otherwise, right? It's disappointing. Yeah. So that's with the bypass, and you see here already that it seems that the droplets are doing, you see there, distorted, they're not really breaking, but this eventually that. And they're going one left, one right. And so that scale, it just says it's working, but as we're moving, so we're arriving here somewhere. So we have just here, that's a point. And focus for a moment on this junction. That's one junction without the bypass. Because that's a bit typical of what happens or what we see when we try to make the trees and so on. And they're made symmetric. Fabrication wise, they're symmetric. And you see, everyone seems to be on the left for a reason we don't know. And keeping on going on the left. At some point, it will go on the right, so you just try to convince you that it's not a yes. At some point, but not before. Yes, thank you. Same my day. Yes, again.
What's the little drop in the bypass on the left?
Oh, I come to that. I'll play it again. Just so that's the typical kind of bizarre sequences that are absolutely unpredictable. So if you wanted to keep the memory of when the droplet was produced, if you have a few steps of this, you lose completely control. And when we tried to make the trees, it was a nightmare. So now I'm sorry, I'm going to replay it. Sorry, this is nice, but now you appreciate better how this thing works nicely compared to what it could do, like the other junction. So now we'll focus on the junction on this side, and actually you'll see there's just a little, I think it's a bubble actually, that got trapped in the bypass, but it's in between the obstacles here, so this little thing is there, but it's not moving, and actually it doesn't affect the function so much, so you can barely see it, but here you have a bypass, and actually everything otherwise is the same, but the droplets definitely go in kind of nice optimization. Yeah.
Can you play with the features of the bypass so that you don't have 50-50? Or so you control yourself 60-40?
We're thinking about that. If you can correct for, what's clear is that you can correct for, we're exploring where you can go with this in the game between the bypass and the architecture of the network changing the length of the arc. Also, what I must say here is, the fact that the bypass work has to do with something that is the comparison of the length of the arm here compared to the distance of the droplets. It's obvious that if the droplets are so far away that the previous droplet has left before the next droplet arrived, the bypass doesn't help. The point I want to make is still the thing I qualify as robust because we have a whole range of length by a factor 2 over which it works. Like when you make the operation diagram by changing the distance between droplet and see when you get these regular patterns and so on. It's not like you have to fine-tune the parameters and there's an operation range that's nice. The operation range is rather large. I mean, of course, you have to be the distance be smaller than this, but that's actually in many functions kind of rather okay. And then you can change the distance by 50% and it still will keep on working. You can make families of bypasses, and if you actually make the droplets, like two droplets per distance here, you again find another very nicely periodic regime, but that's not doesn't have exactly the same feature. Yeah, so you can make this complex. But I'm just saying the kind of idea of essentially one droplet in each arm is also already something where you don't need fine tuning and that works kind of.
But I'm sorry, when you say you don't need fine tuning, you mean there's a range of flow rates for this.
Yeah, there's a range of typical distances between droplets or variation of the size of a droplet and so on that it would be tolerant to and keep on sending them 1, 1, 1, 1, 1.
Right, but the range is not a factor of 10.
No, the range is not a factor of 10, but when you see how you produce the droplets and so on, what you want to overcome is slight variation in the kind of tipping at the beginning when you produce the droplets, and the typical variation are not so large. And already, I think 50% tuning is kind of really nice. I mean, there are many cases when you, I don't know what Darren's experience is, but once first you start to set up the pressure and so on, and you tend to have lots of fluctuation. So just to come back to the semi-log tree, so essentially what we went to, this is my tree with the different arms, so now there's just branches on one side. We made the little bypasses at the different thing, and actually we close it in a wheel, so it's exactly the same topology than this one, but now each of the little ends goes to a kind of common pool in the middle that just to make sure that they have the same pressure. Because otherwise, if you just have your PDMS chip and the thing come out, you sometimes have a little fluctuation, it makes a little drop and capillary variation and so on. So here we have this thing with, I don't know, 8th generation or something like that. And you can look at the velocity as a function of a branch number, and or the residence time by following a given droplet as a function of branch number. And these are log scales, and this is linear in the number of branch. And these are the experimental point, and these are the experimental point. And so you indeed do something whereby you have this kind of exponential range in times on a linear structure. And really, this is something we wouldn't get if we hadn't, at each junction, had this little kind of bypass to control. And what's nice, I must say here, is then we do one half, you actually keep the distance between the droplets the same because you're dividing, you're slowing everything by a factor of 2, but you're sending the same amount of continuous phase and droplets on the two arms, and it's this ratio that decides the distance between droplets. So if your bypass is well engineered for the first junction, it keeps on being engineered for the further one. Otherwise, if you want different ratios, you have to think about making the typical features of a bypass different as you go down the tree. Okay, and so essentially, droplets in networks, even if you don't have breakup, just because they feedback on the hadronic resistance, can give you lots of dynamical effects. In many cases, that's very troublesome, and so the point is, you need control mechanism, and I here advocate for the fact that, and I think Darren will show ways by which actively, and playing with electric fields or other things, you can look at something in the droplets in some way and do sophisticated things, but also just in the engineering of the network, you can use, from this thinking of hadronics, very simple device like the one I showed you that you could put in any junction. Fabrication-wise, that doesn't add anything. That's easily integrated and still that gives you much more robustness in the control of the flow.